Support for Yale Cancer Answers comes from AstraZeneca, providing important treatment options for patients living with different types of lung, bladder, ovarian, breast, and blood cancers. More information at AstraZeneca-US.com. Welcome to Yale Cancer Answers with Drs. Anish Chagpar and Stephen Gore. I'm Bruce Barber. Yale Cancer Answers features the latest information on cancer care by welcoming oncologists and specialists who are on the forefront of the battle to fight cancer. This week, it's a conversation about supportive care for cancer patients with Laura Donnelly. Laura is a clinical social worker in oncology at Smilow Cancer Hospital, and Dr. Gore is a professor of internal medicine and hematology at Yale School of Medicine and director of hematologic malignancies at Smilow.
You know, I'm an old music theater guy, and so when I think of social workers, I immediately think of West Side Story and Dear Kindly Social Worker. They say, go earn some dough, like be a soda jerker, which means like be a schmo. That's the lyrics. Stephen Sondheim wrote that. So that's, I think, many people's experience or fantasy about social workers. They work with, you know, difficult youth and people who need, you know, assistance. How does that fit into oncology? Or, of course, I have totally the wrong stereotype going on.
Well, I think that is a stereotype maybe a lot of people have about social work. And when I started in the field, it was really only when I started in graduate school that I realized how vast and how broad it is. And so I think, well, my first experience with social work as an intern was at a hospice agency in graduate school, and it was a wonderful experience. It was an amazing experience. It was.
Is that something you sought out, or just kind of fell in your lap?
It really did fall into my lap. It was a matter of a placement that worked with my schedule and was close by.
Yeah,
and
serendipity, really.
Right, right. And I thought, oh my goodness, am I going to be able to do this? You know, work
scary,
with people
right?
who are dying, right? And instead, I found it to be actually very life-affirming and very uplifting, and really an honor and a privilege, I think, to be allowed into someone's life at the very end of their life when they're really trying to find some peace and acceptance and closure and a lot of things all at once. So that was my first experience, a little bit different than social workers certainly do work with. Marginalized and people with very difficult issues.
Really important work also.
Absolutely, absolutely. And people with cancer sometimes come from those backgrounds.
Sure.
So it's not that we don't see those issues. They're a part of our society. They're a part of our world. So I think in oncology, it's a very collaborative environment. And I really love that about it, that every person on the team has a different perspective as to how to care best for that patient. And we all work together and inform each other based on our profession and our background. So that's, I think, one of the things I enjoy the most about the environment.
How long have you been an oncology social worker?
So for the last 6 years, I've been in just oncology.
I see. And you focus on a couple areas, particularly disease-wise?
Yes, I work on an outpatient floor at the Smilow Cancer Hospital. And the clinics that are on my floor are gastrointestinal cancers, neuro-oncology, which is brain tumors primarily, and melanoma.
I see. So you're sort of geographically assigned, and whichever patients are in that area are under your purview.
Right.
Or catchment.
Right. And then it's also an infusion area, so sometimes there are patients with other diagnoses, head and neck cancer, or primarily solid tumor cancers come to the area that I work in.
Now, so, how much have you had to learn about the actual diseases, or is that kind of like just by the way, and it's all about the people and their emotions? And
actually, quite a bit. I've learned quite a bit about the types of cancers, and I actually find that very fascinating.
Sure.
Even though I'm a social worker and I love the psychosocial support and emotional support that we provide, I find the science very fascinating and very interesting. And I really sometimes I have the opportunity to be in an appointment with a patient when a doctor's talking, And I'm very fascinated by how they describe the disease process and how the treatments work and why certain ones don't work and what's the best way to approach the disease and manage it, what the side effects will be. I find all of that very interesting. So I have acquired quite a bit of knowledge over the years working in the field with no formal medical training at all.
Well, sure. And do patients ever rely on you or use you as a sounding board to help sort through what they've heard from the doctor in terms of choices, or is that not really in your practice perimeter?
Right. They certainly do ask me sometimes.
I would think so, right?
Sometimes, they've been maybe given two different options. And
hard.
I think, you know, without really, I can't give any medical advice for sure. And I certainly, if it starts to go that way, certainly refer them back to the physician for some clarification, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But I would say what I try to get to is, what is your understanding of these treatments and how are they going to impact you and what matters to you? If a treatment's going to have a lot of side effects and a person, it's very important for them to continue working or it's very important for them to get to a wedding, say, this summer, and these treatments might preclude them from doing that, you know, how can they weigh that? So really helping them kind of navigate what matters to them the most, mm-hmm. or is really what matters to them most long-term survival. So I'm willing to really do the difficult treatments and be completely, you know, almost incapacitated for a few months to have potentially many more years. So it's really, I think what I work with is what matters to a person. And also getting, it's nice to see them get to a place of feeling at peace with that decision. Whatever it is, you need to feel comfortable with it. You need to be able to go to sleep at night with it, wake up in the morning, feel good about it. You know, what's gonna bring you to that place?
You know, it's so interesting that we're talking about this. Yesterday, I was giving a scientific talk about some very bad leukemias, and I was showing some survival statistics for certain subsets where there's very little chance of long-term survival. And I mentioned sort of ethical discussions that my wife, who's an economist but thinks a lot about ethics, and I've had over the years about how one approaches discussing treatment options to healthy patients who don't have a really lot of good choices, you know, how to present their choices in a way that they can feel good about making a choice, mm-hmm. Without taking away hope,
sure.
and really giving patient autonomy without smothering them in depression. It's really, really tough. We got home last night and my wife Amy says, I don't remember any conversation about that. And I told her about an experience I had when I was either a young attending or a fellow in training about such a thing. She didn't remember the conversation, but it changed my life because mm-hmm. she gave me the patient's perspective. Mm-hmm. Felt that I wasn't giving that patient enough information to make a really informed decision. So, you know, I think it's so important because I think as doctors, we tend to be, well, I don't know. We want to do our best. We like to do stuff. And I'm not sure that we're always able, I think with grace, many of us do, but mm-hmm, I think it's a challenge for us to really give the no treatment option fair play. We always talk about it.
Sure, sure.
I think you guys are much better at that.
Well, and I think that then speaks to the team environment that
right.
we are. And I've had really the privilege of working closely with some physicians who, you know, struggle with that. And it's absolutely.
You have patients with pancreas cancer, for
sure.
example, which is pretty tough.
Sure. And also, oncologists sometimes work with patients over a period of years, right? And people are living longer with diagnoses, even very difficult diagnoses. I think there's 15.5 million cancer survivors in our country right now. Mm-hmm. So it's natural that physicians get to know their patients and they get to really care about them and know them. And when the time comes where it seems like doing more treatment is maybe going to be more harmful to the person, having that discussion can be really, really hard. And I think it's important that physicians have a place to share that, how they're feeling about that.
Do you think the physician who has had that long standing relationship is more likely to be forthright at that time? Do you have any experience with that? Or is that person at some point so bonded with the patient that, like the patient, he or she starts to delude themselves a little bit? I think it can go either way.
I think it can, and I think it really depends on the physician. Mm-hmm. I think it absolutely does. And people go into this profession to help and to heal and to cure and to save lives. And that's wonderful. We're so grateful for our physicians that they can do that. Mm-hmm. And I think some have an easier time of being able, and sometimes that relationship does help. Like, look, I care about this person so much, and it's really not in their best interest. They're not going to have a peaceful death if we continue with treatment. And other physicians just really want to keep going forward. And I can empathize with both both sides, for sure, for sure.
I know when my patients are in that kind of position and state, it's very important for me that I be the one who deliver that news. I feel really awful if they're hearing it from someone else. That just doesn't seem right to me. That's just my feeling. It doesn't mean it's easy for me or that I'm happy about it. And I think, you know, I'm probably sometimes a little, you know, blindered as well. Maybe I should have thought about that a month or two ago. I don't know.
Right. No, and I agree with you 100%. I think sometimes patients a lot of times intuitively know when things are not going well. They intuitively know, but they maybe don't want to say anything. Am I jinxing myself?
Right. Or if I say it out loud, it'll be true.
If I say it out loud, it may happen, you know. But they intuit. They say, you know, things are really not going well.
I don't feel like it's
going
well.
I know this is my fourth treatment or my fourth line of treatments. I know the options are running out, but until they really hear that, and they need to hear it from their doctor, it really isn't real, or they really can't take the steps that they need to really prepare.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, if patients are expressing those kinds of things to you, mm-hmm. You know, I assume you ask whether the doctor's talked to them about it. Do you kind of push them to ask the doctor? Or do you talk to the doctor on the side and saying, look, you got to, how does that work?
A little bit of both sometimes.
I would say
a little bit of both. It depends. Our clinic and our practices are very busy and they move very fast. And so some of it is timing as to, you know, do I have a few minutes to pull a physician aside and mention, you know, oh, this patient's really wondering about this, or this patient's really worried about this. And sometimes the patient might be worried about something when there really are a lot more options,
right.
You know. It's amazing to see some patients be so, so sick and then see them a few months or a year later when they've stopped treatment and they're so much better.
Mm-hmm. Amazing, right?
So it really can kind of go either way too, but I do try to facilitate that communication.
Yeah, I think it's important.
And encourage patients to advocate for themselves too.
Now, do all patients have scheduled appointments with you, or do you kind of circulate and pop in? How does that work?
So we attempt, all of us social workers, we attempt to meet every patient on the first day of treatment, perhaps.
In
my area, it's the first day of treatment because they're typically getting treatment in the outpatient setting. So we attempt to. There is a screening that's done with every patient at the very first appointment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a scale of 1 to 10. It's called a distress thermometer. It's a scale of 1 to 10. Patients report on distress in various aspects of their life. Those who score towards the top are really a priority for us to connect with, whether it's by phone or in person, to really help them, to see how we can help them cope better, how we can relieve that distress, what we can do together as a team, you know, as a social worker in the community. So,
yeah. So they get your first attention.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we need to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more about supportive care for cancer patients and the help that social workers provide with Laura Donnelly.
Support for Yale Cancer Answers comes from AstraZeneca, providing important treatment options for women living with advanced ovarian cancer. Learn more at AstraZeneca-US.com. This is a medical minute about pancreatic cancer, which represents about 3% of all cancers in the U.S. and about 7% of cancer deaths. Clinical trials are currently being offered at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers for the treatment of advanced stage and metastatic pancreatic cancer using chemotherapy and other novel therapies. FOLFIRINOX, a combination of five different chemotherapies, is the latest advance in the treatment of metastatic pancreatic cancer, and research continues at centers around the world looking into targeted therapies and a recently discovered marker, HENT1. This has been a Medical Minute brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Answers. This is Dr. Stephen Gore. I'm joined tonight by my guest, Laura Donnelly. We've been discussing supportive care for cancer patients, and in particular, the role that social workers play. Laura, I'd like to come back to one of the very first things you mentioned, which was during this internship you had during your social work training at a hospice, and you said you found the work life-affirming. Could you elaborate on that? I think that's just a fascinating comment.
Well, I think when people are approaching their own mortality and also the family members that are around them, I think it leads a person to really focus on what is most meaningful in their life and what has been most meaningful. And perhaps sometimes there's regret, or perhaps somebody felt like they spent a lot of their life maybe doing a job they didn't really like or didn't really love, and that maybe some of that time wasn't as meaningful. But what can I do now to sort of make every day more meaningful and incorporate more of that into my life? So I think it's a time in which a person really reflects and reviews their whole life and the adversity and the difficulty and what the value was in those difficult experiences and the joy and the good moments that they've maybe experienced in a life. So it's like the culmination of a really good book or something.
And right.
So that's and I think too, to see people make progress and go and grow and change is also just very rewarding.
Mm-hmm. Is there any kind of, the word that comes to my mind is curriculum or process, kind of formal process for helping people negotiate that kind of existential review and abyss, or is this just something you get skilled at? It's really interesting to me.
That's a good question.
Somebody must write about that kind of stuff, I would think, yeah.
Well, I have to say, I think it was when I look back on my training, I didn't learn that those skills specifically in the classroom, but more from the people, my mentors and my people in the field who were doing it. And there were many educational opportunities just in that hospice year and ongoing now in my current career for continued education, for conferences, for experts in the field. And so I always took advantage of those opportunities to learn more because it would help me understand my patients better and it would help me help them more. So I would say not really a curriculum. It really was like learning from those who were doing it.
It would seem that it would be nice for patients if they had even a workbook, you know, right? A guy,
right.
You know, we have what to expect when you're expecting, but, you know, right. Really like how to putting your life in order or something. I don't know. It just seems like there's so much opportunity because probably not everybody has access to thoughtful people like you. And your time is limited, I assume.
Right, right. Again, a really good point. And I don't think that there is a manual out there like that.
Here's your future. You can be even more famous.
Right, right. And some people are a little more resourceful and a little bit more proactive in their own initiatives to seek out that those kinds of things, and other people aren't. It doesn't mean that they don't get there. You know, there are other people that help them, or they come to a place of acceptance without a lot of that. You know,
it was interesting. You know, so when my mom was dying of pancreas cancer, she was a woman who was never going to discuss the D word, and it was. I think, you know, my sibs and I have regret about not being able to really discuss the anxiety she must have had and stuff. But that was her choice, and we respected it. My mother-in-law was a little more open, and she kind of discussed some kind of existential thoughts she had had with her daughters. Not deeply again. And then I have some patients who really, just exhibit, you know, and I call it grace, and I don't mean it really in a religious sense, but I mean really an amazing sense of peace and, I don't know, insight or acceptance that I'm not sure I'd ever be able to have. I mean, it's really fascinating. I really so respect and in some ways envy those patients, and I'd like to bottle it and learn from them. I try to, but it's, right. I don't know, it's so different from patient to patient.
Absolutely. And I think it's very important, like even in your own family, respecting where the person is at. You know, I try to think of it as a storybook, and they really get to write that last chapter.
Right.
And if that last chapter is to continue to protect family members by not talking about it, that's okay. I think as a social worker, a lot of times it's our job to maybe open the door for some discussion. And if, you know, that door gets shut quickly, then...
that they're telling you something, right?
Right.
Yeah, no, I often find that our medical staff, particularly in the hospital, not just medical, I mean the entire health staff, patient care staff, is very focused on making sure people have a quote-unquote good death, what's good death in our eyes,
right?
And that, you know, we address resuscitation issues immediately. Like, it's the most important thing. Like, God forbid somebody's put on a ventilator who doesn't want it. And, of course, we want to respect those wishes. But I think that many of us can't step back and say, first of all, we don't know how we'd feel in their shoes.
Right.
And we're not in their shoes, and we're not that person.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, we have to watch out for our own hubris about it, I think.
Sure. And I think as social workers, we have to be really aware of how we're feeling and really not project that onto the person, but to be aware of it, because we are going to feel that way. If a patient says, oh, I want everything, you know, you might have a certain reaction to that.
Where do you process those feelings, frustration or?
I think it's really important to collaborate and connect with other social workers who are doing the same kind of work. So we have opportunities together as a team to do that and to really get some input from our colleagues that's a little bit more objective to help us with that.
Nice. So you feel well supported that way.
Yes, definitely.
You don't want to have to be home stewing about some bad interaction or some patient you're really unhappy about, I would think.
Right. No, we, as social workers, a part of our job is our own self-care.
Yeah, I would think so, yeah.
Right. And so we really try to, I learn from my patients a lot too, especially those at end of life. How do I make my days more meaningful?
Right.
So, I think it's something that has to be intentional. Mm-hmm. You have to really carve out time to do.
Mm-hmm.
But that getting that energy and that reinvigoration helps me be able to give more to my patients the next day.
What happens to patients who either the patients or family members where, you know, maybe their grief reactions or their whatever is sort of assuming more of a, I don't know, difficult, really sort of difficult problem that might either need some kind of more intensive therapy or medication. What happens to those patients? How do we get them support?
Right. So we collaborate with a lot of partners in the community too. We collaborate with mental health practitioners who are in private practice, with cancer-specific organizations, with psychiatrists at times. So we really, when we do an assessment with a person, we really look at their entire social context and their history and maybe some issues that were there prior to diagnosis, and really collaborate with and connect them with people, encourage them to get connected, talk about the ways that they can cope with this, but also giving a space to allow some of that. For example, some people, I think, can go through a period of time of being very angry.
Right.
And that anger can certainly come out towards the medical professionals, you know, when they present in clinic.
Yes.
And I think it can sometimes, the first reaction can be to take that personally, you know, and, well, I'm trying to help this person and they don't appreciate it. But I think it's taking a step back and realizing this is a part of the process. This is a part of their grief process. And I can be available and I can listen to that and I can validate that. And then I can help them try to move beyond that. And say, you know, I can see you're in a lot of distress. How can we help you with this? These are some things that have helped other people in the past, because, you know, I want you to feel good every day, you know, even living with this difficult illness or your family member's difficult illness. What can we do to make this better? So I think, and I say to patients too, how you're going to get through this is not going to be one thing.
Mm-hmm.
It is going to be a variety of things, you know, a variety of coping skills that you already have that you're going to acquire. It's going to be support from your family, from perhaps a faith community, from the community you live in. It is going to be a multitude of things. It's really not going to just be counseling or just a support group. It's really going to be a lot of things. I think that's what I see. And the more things you can avail yourself to, I think the better you're going to feel.
Mm-hmm. And what about the physician who's being attacked? Are you available for her as well?
I absolutely am. I'm available to talk about it. I'm available to problem solve with them. How can we mitigate this situation in the future? You know, is there a way to kind of prepare the patient ahead of time? Are they angry about a wait time, or are they just angry about the news they got, or... did the plan have to change for some reason, perhaps a really good reason, and they weren't expecting it, and mm-hmm. That set off a reaction? How can we be proactive and plan for that ahead of time, I think? Or sometimes it's really just giving a physician an opportunity to say, gosh, that was really awful. I didn't know what I could do. They were so angry. And just kind of giving a moment to sort of debrief before you move on to the next
recoup,
patient.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. You know, I used to work in Maryland, and in Maryland, the social workers, I think, had a lot more, I'm not sure what the word is, you know, sort of case responsibilities for helping with paperwork and getting, mm-hmm. you know, durable supplies and beds and things like that. It seems like that's not so much the case in Connecticut, or at least here in our medical center, that there are other professionals who kind of deal with a lot of that more practical stuff. Am I right about that?
I would say that's the case at Smilo. There is a care management department that does a lot of those practical things, setting up visiting nurses, getting durable medical equipment, things like that. We as social workers, though, we do provide a lot of community resources. So that is a part of our job, too. There is sometimes some paperwork involved and forms and things like that. But I would say our top priority is really helping patients cope with the illness.
Laura Donnelly is a clinical social worker in oncology at Smilo Cancer Hospital. If you have questions, the address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and past editions of the program are available in audio and written form at yalecancercenter.org. I'm Bruce Barber, reminding you to tune in each week to learn more about the fight against cancer here on Connecticut Public Radio.